Summer.
No migrants more in.
No Europe without Christianity.
An alliance also with Russia.
Welcome to EU Scream, the podcast that guides you through stories coming from the EU. We talk about the news a bit differently and with people who really know what they're talking about. This is episode 104. I'm your host, James Cantor. This week with Stanley Pignol, Brussels bureau chief and Charlemagne columnist at The Economist. Hey, Stanley.
Hi.
How you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
I apologize this week for my voice, which is a bit croaky, but
distinguished.
You know,
distinguished.
True commitment to podcast means that you podcast through any sort of vocal disturbance. And thank you for opening up your closet for our recording.
People are going to talk.
The sound is exquisite. Stanley, we first met in Brussels when you were with the Financial Times. I was with the International Herald Tribune and New York Times back here in Brussels in the early part of the last decade. The kind of hard right, ultra-conservative nationalists, those people that we're going to be talking about in this episode, they were still very fringe operators, right? Back then, did you expect to see them getting so much stronger?
So they're already around, right? And some of the same people are around. Remember Viktor Orban already in 2010 was a Hungarian premier. But what you've seen is by fits and starts, they have gained in strength, certainly in terms of kind of being more present around the European Council table. So like national leaders, even now in the case of Giorgia Meloni. There's no French election now, which isn't a question about, you know, will the far right win? And they're in far more countries than before. That having been said, there's been another evolution, which is, you know, some of these parties have come in, not all of them, but some of these parties have come in far closer to the political center. So the Rassemblement National, as it is now in France, the National Rally, is a far
this
more
is Marine
modern
Le Pen's.
Marine Le Pen's that she took over from her father. Her father was a kind of like a rabid ultra-nationalist. She has taken over the mantle, but it is far closer to the political center now. Whether that's a sort of cynical political strategy to gain centrist votes to then enact a far-right agenda, or whether that's just a true evolution, you know, who really knows? But so those parties have evolved, and the way we talk about them has evolved. They used to be kind of far beyond the political pale, what we call the cordon sanitaire, you know, that it was kind of considered nearly improper to have any kind of alliances with them or even debate them. And mostly, it depends on the countries, but mostly that has at least evolved. So there's a spectrum now, right? It used to be kind of us and them, and now there are many countries in which there are some parties that are really beyond the political fringe. There are some parties that are centrist, and there are parties that are kind of in the middle.
You know what I would say? That back when we were both in Brussels in the early part of the last decade, we'd had the financial crisis. You know, that had an impact on domestic politics and the rise of the right. But then it really took sort of the migration emergencies of 2015, 2016 to put, you know, to put some momentum behind some of these parties.
Yeah, they were always around, but I agree. You know, that's clearly their big issue is migration. And, you know, even when the migration situation eases, you find that, you know, it's not like they disappear. Yeah. Once they gain some political traction, once people kind of get to know them. But it is clearly, yeah, a recurring theme.
So, Stanley, you went off to The Economist after that period in Brussels, where you worked in Paris and Mumbai, and then we met up again when you took your current role back in Brussels as Charlemagne columnist for The Economist. Charlemagne being the name of the column on Europe. And then we met again this past week at a conference of hard right politicians, academics, and lawyers.
I was surprised to see you there. I mean, you know, I didn't have you in that camp, but to each his own.
I'm how can I say?
A man of many ideologies.
I'm hard right curious, but really curious what they're up to. And this was a meeting, this conference was of the so-called national conservatives. That conference made headlines in recent days for the way Brussels authorities had tried to shut down this conference.
The organisers of a conference in Brussels, which is hosting right-wing politicians from across Europe, say they've been told to shut down the event. The organisers, who were rejected by two other planned venues after a series of protests, have said they'll seek legal advice. The local mayor had expressed concerns about public safety.
Yeah, very good afternoon, Jane. Quite extraordinary scenes here in Brussels today. As you may well be able to see, there is a policeman talking to the owner of the venue in which this national conservative conference is taking place. The police essentially are trying to shut this thing down. They've had an order from...
The think tank that organised the event legally challenged the decision, claiming freedom of speech was under attack.
Now, these national conservatives, they are a very hard right bunch of people. They channel a lot of the usual hard right stuff: family, faith, fatherland, anger at governing elites, the misguided belief that economic and political problems can be easily solved by kicking out foreigners. Those sentiments are not a million miles away from a Trump rally, but NatCons, as these national conservatives call themselves, they don't wear Make America Great Again hats. The dress code is more...
variable.
Well, it's more university common room, right? And some of the men sport waistcoats with pocket squares.
A lot of waistcoats.
A lot of waistcoats. And there were a couple of Flemish nationalist youths in old world university caps worn at a tilt. Squint a bit and they could be Jean-Paul Gaultier models. I don't think they'd like that. So many of the women in these sort of elegantly patterned silk scarves, speeches are peppered with learned quotations and scholarly references. And you know, the NatCons are bigly into tradition and history, including the Catholic Church and the Reconquista and all that stuff. And they can't seem to get enough of the medieval period. And they totally fetishize Europe as a Christian project versus Islam. So, Stanley, writing a column that allows you to identify as Charlemagne?
I mean, right up their alley.
The first emperor of the West after the fall of the Roman Empire, who'd had some skirmishes with the Saracens before he became emperor. Surely this title gives this kind of crowd a bit of a frisson.
That's right. Natural affinity. The problem is I work for The Economist, which is basically the exact ideological opposite of that crowd. We are the sort of in-house globalist newspaper that they rail against. So we don't share many ideas with them. But just like you, we are hard right curious. You know, it's an emerging and important political force in Europe, certainly in America. So yeah, we go where the thinking is.
Let's get down to it. Why were we and a bunch of journalists together at this conference of so-called national conservatives?
So you were there when they had their first conference in Brussels in 2022. And I wasn't. And I think this is actually quite telling, because they had a conference in Brussels that basically has been long, long forgotten, right? And the reason it was long forgotten is because there are lots of these conferences in which people rail about, you know, family values and against globalism and against George Soros and wokes and so on. And they're generally quite forgettable. The reason why this one wasn't was because of this incredibly ham-fisted attempt by the Brussels local authorities to ban this conference. It completely backfired in that it gave the people at this conference this kind of feeling of being, you know, rebellious and, you know, standing up to these illiberal liberals. And it also gave it a ton of publicity. And ultimately, that's why, having planned to write a completely different column, I rocked up. In fact, I more or less had to beg to be allowed in to this NatCon conference, which already, when I arrived, and you were already there in the front row, I should note, was happening sort of behind closed shutters, right? This was like a hard thing to get into and very, very far from the original venue that they had in mind, which was the venue that you were at 2 years ago, which was kind of this grand gilded conference center. And so a few days before the conference, this conference venue had decided to boot the NatCons out, essentially under political pressure that one of the 19 local Brussels mayors had kind of indicated that policing would be difficult and there was going to be some so-called anti-fascist protests. I mean, this is nonsense, right? I mean, the EU quarter, Brussels, is crawling with conferences, crawling with national leaders where security is complex. So clearly this was just like a ham-fisted attempt at closing this thing down. And it worked.
So your column, just to give it a shout out, was how a conservative conference morphed into a crisis of liberalism. And you were, you know, I think you, in that column, you called this conference a reactionary gabfest, which seemed about right to me. And as you say,
lovingly.
And as you say, the events turned very much in the reactionary's favor. But let's just be clear here who we're dealing with. This was this group's 9th conference and their 2nd in Brussels. There have been others in Rome and Miami and Washington. And in Brussels this week, there were around 50 speakers from the world of the hard right. And one of the really big ticket speakers was Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban. In fact, it's Orban's allies in the Hungarian parliament who generously funded one of the main organizers of the conference. That's a think tank called MCC. And when I say generously, I mean MCC has, in recent years, received a 10% stake in the oil and gas company MOL, which is a Hungarian oil and gas company, and other assets.
As of spring 2022, MCC's Verite programs are available to 5,300 students in 24 municipalities. MCC also wants to make its programs known to the public in Western European cities. MCC was established more than 25 years ago.
And there was the highly polarizing French presidential candidate there, Eric Zemmour. He's previously been fined for incitement to racial discrimination and for incitement of hate against Muslims. Zemmour's also said that he dreams of a French Putin. He only got 7% last time he ran for president, so maybe that's some solace. And then there was, of course, Nigel Farage, who spoke there back in Brussels, who helped leave Britain out of the EU and is a friend of Donald Trump's. And there were others, too.
A speaker who's under investigation for right-wing extremism. Another speaker argued that Christchurch mosque shooter had legitimate concerns. Another speaker argued gay marriage is a destructive experiment. How can that be acceptable that Suella Braverman thinks it's okay to put herself on a stage with those?
No, I don't.
And the reference there on Sky News was to a former Home Secretary. That was the UK's Suella Braverman. She's a hard right firebrand who has tried to send irregular migrants entering Britain to Rwanda. We also heard her speak at the conference.
Oh, we did.
And I mean, it was not electrifying.
It was not electrifying. It didn't help that one of the upshots of this conference having to move venues so many times and the cops being outside was that the caterers weren't allowed in for a while. So at one point, I think we were expecting lunch.
Your theory that Suella Braverman was not given the attention is that we were hungry?
I mean, it was like 1 o'clock or something, and it was meant to be lunch after a hard morning of listening to, political tirades.
Faith, family, and fatherland.
That's right. And when we were expecting lunch, we got quite a long lecture on the dastardliness of human rights lawyers. But I want to come back to the funding of the conference. So they call themselves conservatives. And I think actually the US and Europe mean fundamentally different things when they talk about conservatives. So in the US, it's people like, you know, Ron DeSantis, who's a kind of a big hero of these conferences. And in Europe, it's someone like Viktor Orban. But the idea in the US that a state asset like MOL, the oil company, would be partly handed over to political allies of the national leader to fund the ideology. I mean, it's the least conservative thing in the world. It's the least conservative thing in the world. And somehow, I think the Americans who organize these conferences in good faith don't quite seem to have clocked that these are completely different people. These are not their people. There is nothing in common between Ron DeSantis or even Donald Trump and Viktor Orban other than the faith and family stuff. They have a completely different conception of the state, a completely different conception of politics, but they kind of find themselves in these kind of alliances of convenience.
And you don't think that were Ron DeSantis to be president, he would not take the organs of the state and fund, you know, he would not sort of bend the rules to create echo chamber think tanks.
They don't need to in America. I think part of the reason is you don't need to in America. There's enough money kind of sloshing around. I find the whole structure of the financing of the Hungarian, it's a big Hungarian export now. I mean, it's like on par with like, you know, goulash and sausages is this ideology of, you know, nationalism and a certain idea of Europe that is not kind of run by the EU, but is run by nation states that occasionally meet in Brussels. But the way it's funded, I find is fundamentally actually quite weird.
Now, normally, these NatCon jamborees, they fly under the radar. I covered one in 2022 in Brussels, as you said earlier, and I seem to be the only journo from a non-right outlet. And the narrative that year was that it's Putin who let down, because this is just after the invasion,
just after
full
the awkward,
invasion of Ukraine.
Awkward.
Awkward moment. The narrative that year was that it's Putin who let down the nationalist right by fully invading Ukraine and reverting to imperialism, rather than them sort of acknowledging that the far right may have been hopelessly naive or willingly complicit by previously cozying up to Putin. But this time, a lot of reporters showed up. And this time, the press corps was paying attention. And Stanley, the first sign of trouble that started drawing everyone's attention was at this place called the Concert Noble.
Yeah.
And pressure was put on that venue, or the venue itself got cold feet?
I think it's a bit of both, right? And there's a lot of he said, she said. You know, what we know is that at that venue, there is a mix in between the venue, the local mayors, and the police, where somehow kind of technical reasons are found not to hold these events. I mean, this is completely illegitimate. It is, you know, there is absolutely no problem in policing, you know, what are likely to be, you know, a few dozen protesters at most coming to these events. Brussels is so used to this kind of thing. Concert Noble, you know, you and I have been to dozens of events at this thing. I have seen kind of presidents and prime ministers there. It's very easy to cordon off if you need. And same thing. So after Concert Noble pulled out, there was a second venue, the Sofitel.
So the first location is the Concert Noble. They're turfed out of there, and then they have to go find another venue.
Yeah.
And that venue is the Sofitel Hotel.
Which is like a sort of a stalwart of political meetings in Brussels. And in fact, I had been to an MCC event with Judith Varga, who's one of Viktor Orban's henchwomen. So, you know, they were kind of familiar with their work, and they host a lot of political events. So anyway, that's where they ended up until they didn't.
Yeah. And the Sofitel is right slap bang in the middle of the EU quarter. Ministers and heads of state and government stay there all the time.
MEPs' parents as well, when they're trundling lots of cash around.
Yeah. You're absolutely right.
That's sorry, the reference is
to something called Qatargate.
Yeah.
And
it had a little starring role that some of the money allegedly, I think we need to say alleged every third word in this.
Yeah,
some of the alleged money allegedly may have allegedly gone through the alleged Sofitel.
Yeah, big bribery case involving the state of Qatar and MEPs from
allegedly.
The Socialist Party, allegedly.
Yeah.
And a suitcase stuffed full of cash going in and out of that hotel. Or going in?
Going into that hotel and then out with the police, I think.
So there was a summit coming up and lots of dignitary stay at the Sofitel. I mean, did that have anything to do with anything?
Oh, probably. I mean, it wasn't the smartest decision in the world, maybe by the Sofitel, to agree to have this hard right summit with like several hundred people at the same time as there was an EU summit where a bunch of national leaders and their delegations stay in the Sofitel. But ultimately, they had agreed to do it. And it got to the point where, you know, the conservatives, the NatCons, were setting up the stage at the Sofitel. So, you know, something went wrong. And what we do know is that, again, the mayor of this particular Brussels commune had made a point of saying, you know, I don't want the far right on my patch.
So then they're forced to find a third place. I mean, I find out about the third place via an email early on Tuesday morning that they've ended up at a venue named, I'd say a bit optimistically, Claridge.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a dance hall / wedding venue.
It is not Claridge's in London.
It is not Claridge's in London. There are sticky floors. There are glitter ball style stars painted on the ceilings. It really doesn't bear much resemblance to its namesake, Claridge's.
It's a perfectly nice venue.
The five-star London hotel in Mayfair.
It's a perfectly nice venue, but it is in a sort of somewhat down-at-heel neighborhood of Brussels. Hosts mainly kind of concerts, weddings, and some events of this sort.
You picked out one particular
The Shrek Rave.
What?
Bring out your inner ogre. 9th of May, let's all go. Should be wild.
A Shrek Rave.
A Shrek Rave. It's a thing.
So they're all set up at Claridge.
Yeah.
This very, and
in fact, do a remarkable job
I have to say, the people from MCC and all the others, they didn't look too underslept, but they cannot have slept at all.
They cannot have slept at all.
Yeah.
No, but such is the self-sacrifice of conservatives.
Yeah, the self-sacrifice of the hard right.
Of the hard right.
So, Stanley, what happens then? Yet another Brussels mayor doesn't want them there. And on what grounds does this mayor act and what does he do?
The socialist mayor, the third mayor of this commune of Brussels, having seen two of his fellow Brussels mayors kick out the hard right, decides, well, I'm going to kick out the hard right as well. Remember that both the EU, but also Belgium, have elections coming up in early June, right? I think this is probably not a small factor, right? People are playing to their audience a little bit.
And here's our friend Bruno Waterfield reporting for Times Radio on what's unfolding.
And the real reason why everyone's just up and taking notice, the real reason why lots of people want to ban this conference here is Vlaams Belang, which is a hard right nationalist party in Belgium, is expected to be the biggest party in national elections and European elections here in June. And that's a real reason. That's a real reason why all the socialist mayors in Brussels are desperately trying to stop this conference from happening. A conference ban.
I don't think anybody is kind of penalized for goading the hard right amongst their electorate. And so the third mayor decides to put an administrative order saying, you know, you are not authorized or whatever to have this conference. But to the point where actually cops came in, right? Like while Nigel Farage was speaking, it wasn't like hundreds of riot police, to be clear. I think it was three cops that kind of came in and kind of had a look around. It was like, we're meant to close this place down, but I'm not entirely sure why. I mean, they didn't look entirely convinced of their authority. So maybe quite wisely kind of decided, you know, we'll somewhat close it down. We're going to stop people from coming in. And we're going to stop people, you know, if people come out, they can't come back in. They didn't want to create a scene, which I think, you know, actually the police come out of this okay, considering. There's a bit of a weird, also kind of come to think of it, you know, conservatives and the rule of law is meant to be a thing. And the police did actually ask them to close this thing down. And the conservatives were like, yeah, like, no.
We're not doing it, mate.
No, yeah, exactly. So we're just going to listen to Nige. I must say the journalists would have, you know, the journalists wouldn't have minded a little bit more kind of excitement. But the Belgian police were very, you know, they de-escalated, or they opted not to escalate the situation, which turned out to be a very wise move.
Exactly. I mean, from the NatCon's publicity, the publicity of the people who put on the conference, you'd think that they'd been hit by the Navy SEALs or some kind of, you know, special operations unit. But as you say, it was a few local
cops. Slightly confused cops.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So as I told you earlier, the authorities have decided to shut off the event, and I'm here to signify you the decision. So I have the papers here, and I'm here to enforce the decision. So it's a decision of the burgomaster, the mayor,
okay,
to shut off the event. So it is the motivation lies within, and you have different articles that explain the decision.
All of this is happening while we are looking at.
You and I
are sitting together.
That's right.
And we're looking at Nigel Farage speaking while all of this is happening.
I'm taking notes. You're clapping. I mean, it's, you know, it's
cut. All right. And Lisa O'Carroll of The Guardian shot video of the police entering just as Farage was speaking.
Thank you.
I have seen a succession of people get elected to Brussels, right? As MEPs.
And Farage is really ginning it up. We're seeing him and others playing this attempt to shut down their conference for all it's worth. And Farage later on says that if they shut it down, it will be with him on the stage.
Yeah, that's right.
I understand the police are very, very keen to close this down. So if they're going to close it down, they can close it down with me on stage, can't they? Whether it happens or not, I don't know. But I've been told there's time for questions. Do we organisers have a roving mic?
And in fact, he kind of stayed on stage a little bit longer than he was meant to. He took a Q&A session, which I'm pretty sure was like, you know, the cops were around. And for them, it would just have been perfect to have, you know, Farage, you know, taken off the stage, handcuffed, lightly beaten by the cops. But of course, you know, none of that happened. But you're right. I mean, if you listen to the organizers, it did sound like it was a bit more dramatic than it was.
And by that time, authorities realized it would be even more of a media circus if the police emptied the hall. And instead of marching everyone out, they settled for just not letting anyone else in. And then the Belgian prime minister steps in, right? What does he say?
Yeah. Alexander De Croo, who is a liberal prime minister of Belgium, tweets, you know, what happened today at the Claret was unacceptable. And, you know, there's a constitutional principle of, you know, freedom of association and free speech.
Yeah. And De Croo is really, he's very attentive to this idea that Belgium is on the side of freedom of speech and peaceful assembly. As he says in his tweet, you know, municipal autonomy is a cornerstone of our democracy. Hello, mayors. You have autonomy, but you can never overrule the Belgian constitution guaranteeing freedom of speech and peaceful assembly since 1830. Banning political meetings is unconstitutional, full stop.
So towards the end of the day, kind of reason prevails a little bit. So firstly, the organizers had put some kind of administrative appeal against this order that had been imposed by the local mayor. And I think early on, we're fairly hopeful that it was going to go their way.
This to me is very interesting. The appeal against the police order to shut down the venue. Let me put it this way. I heard one of the speakers at the event say that J.D. Vance, the Trumpy U.S. senator, was getting involved, writing to the Belgian ambassador in the U.S. So there was this kind of like transatlantic dimension. And also highlighting that transatlantic dimension was who the NatCons used to bring a lawsuit to reverse the local mayor's order. And that legal effort came from the European branch of what may be the key lawfare actor on the American ultra-conservative right, the Alliance Defending Freedom. It's a group that the Southern Poverty Law Center designates as an anti-LGBT hate group, and it formerly had Mike Johnson, who's now the Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives.
Who we like now.
Who's a theocrat. Well, and wants a biblical republic.
But he may get this Ukraine thing done. So now we like him.
But he may yet get a much-needed aid to Ukraine against the wishes of Marjorie Taylor Greene. Anyway, he used to be an attorney. He used to be an attorney with Alliance Defense.
Is that right?
So, Stanley, this drama with transatlantic dimensions is playing out in this rather down-at-heel dance and events venues on a street with crumbling facades and dusty shop windows. And they win.
And they win.
They win against this court order. And that emergency court decision was handed down by what? The Conseil d'État?
Yeah, which is like the highest administrative court. I mean, honestly, if you'd asked me to guess when that ruling would have come, I would have guessed somewhere like, you know, second half of 2027.
Yeah, exactly. Have you ever seen Belgian justice?
Nothing has ever worked this fast in Belgium, right? I mean, they've been renovating their Palais de Justice since I was there last time. It's more than a decade. But clearly for this kind of thing, you know, they managed to get it done, which again is to the credit
overnight
of the Belgian system. It's also, dare I say, a credit to the foundational liberal norms that we heard being challenged quite profoundly on the stage of the NatCon. I mean, all these dastardly human rights lawyers that Suella Braverman was railing against are the very same people who ultimately, belatedly, ensured that the NatCons could have their conference. So, you know, ironic and good news.
The initial idea that there should be closures of the conference was largely to do with the idea that there would be disturbances, right? Yeah. And I think the Conseil d'État really decided that those risks were very much outweighed by the need to respect freedom of speech and, you know, to allow political meetings to happen.
And incidentally, I mean, you know, how much disturbance was there?
Well, the idea that there would be disturbances, I mean, I really don't know. That did seem a bit far-fetched. There were around 100 people just a little ways away. They were kept a little ways away. Some black and red Antifa flags And I say Antifa, which, you know, is shorthand.
You're using the language of the NatCons here a little bit.
Yeah, but they call themselves Antifa too.
Oh, they call themselves
they
Antifa.
Do.
Okay.
They do call fine, themselves fine, Antifa. Fine, fine. It's just that the right and Donald Trump usually say Antifa to sort of gin up the idea that they're very
right,
dangerous.
But they've adopted the word. Okay, fine.
Yeah, no. And, you know, I went and spoke to them and they bore every resemblance, this group of Antifa, to students and activists.
Right.
And their spokesperson was extremely bright and reasonable, I thought. Here she is speaking to me on Tuesday evening about why the NatCons needed to be pushed out.
So freedom of speech, basically, it's a right that is guaranteed by the government. We're not the government. We are other people disagreeing with them, and we don't have to listen to what they're saying. Second, freedom of speech is not the freedom to say racist and hate speech. So this is a criminal offense to hold racist and hate speech. And so shielding behind freedom of speech and the language of human rights is just a tactical move that they are making. And we're just seeing and showing that, no, this is just a criminal offense that they are doing. And also, lastly, I mean, freedom of speech is the double standard for them. In Hungary, people are not able to hold freedom of speech. In the government that many of them want to put, it's not a government that's going to defend human rights, to say the least, rather the opposite. And so just pretending to just have 1 year on rights to just spread their hate is just, I mean, a move that we are trying to denounce. It was also a fundraiser, so we shouldn't forget it was not just like we want to speak together, etc. It was a way for them to gather money, and money enables them to spread their ideas as well and organize. So it's a big victory to have impeded that.
But the comments by De Croo, the Belgian prime minister, and the favorable court order, and the way that even enemies of the national conservatives said that they should have the right to meet and speak, it added up to an extraordinary moral victory for the NatCons.
Absolutely.
And they totally made the most of it. Speaker after speaker on Wednesday lined up to call this proof of cancel culture and so on and so forth. Each of them was able to crow about the communications win that they'd scored. Some were delighted at the Streisand effect.
Mm.
Do you know about the Streisand
effect? Of course.
This is the syndrome or effect named after the film star.
She spoke on the second day, right?
Barbara Streisand. She sang. She was a musical interlude. This is the syndrome or effect named after the film star Barbara Streisand, who tried to get a photo of her mansion on the California coast removed from the internet, but only ended up drawing more attention to its location. So the Streisand effect has become a way of saying how seeking an injunction to prohibit something can lead to increased publicity. And the parallel here is how censorship so often backfires when the public perceives an attempt to repress speech. I mean, the bottom line is that this was a total own goal.
Oh, completely. Completely. And this is where I think the mayors of Brussels, who thought they were being clever, kind of were really not very clever, you know, playing right into the hands of this group of politicians and activists and academics and so on, who rail against cancel culture, which I think actually is a thing on some U.S. campuses. I mean, we shouldn't play it down, right? I think they're in the U.S., it's something that people should be mindful of. And I think there is some intolerance and a lot of it comes from the left. And we should be very kind of open and honest about discussing it. I don't think it's such a big thing in Europe. I don't think, frankly, European campuses are well organized enough to have cancel culture. When I was at the LSE, I mean, God, we used to have some rum characters being invited to speak, but it was just like, you know, like some kind of student society that would invite people over. It's like, yeah, come speak. And you know, it was like people would protest and it would be fine. And there was no kind of big thing about
Look, Stanley, we see systems of power differently now.
We see systems of power. Are you saying this was a long time ago? It was quite a long time ago.
And actually, I mean, I think that one can have a really, I feel like I should push back a little bit at what you said about cancel culture. I think that's a different podcast. But I would just say that we do really see society differently these days. And remedying these, you know, these imbalances of power is kind of part of that.
I agree. I think there's an intelligent debate to be had about, you know, what you tolerate, what you don't tolerate. It's fine. I just think it's it's in a different place in America compared to Europe. And of course, it strengthens the conservative cause to be up against something. Right now, a lot of times they're against nothing. There's nobody cares. Nobody's responding to what they're saying. And it would kind of benefit them.
Okay. So I like what you're saying there, that essentially by screaming cancel culture, they're punching a straw man.
Exactly. I mean, it just doesn't happen that much in Europe. We don't kind of care that much. As you said, nobody came to this, nobody cared about this conference 2 years ago. To have a conference, it's fine. This thing was held, you know, on the day before European summit. It's completely normal for national leaders to come and give these blowhard speeches. And, you know, it would have just gone completely, you know,
under the radar. So there were some neologisms in response. One of them being Bolsha wokeism.
It is my favorite.
Political left-wingers have their ideological project. And I think migration is one part of this project. Other part is wokeism, or I call it Bolsha wokeism. Yeah. They use migration to elect a new people. Yeah? They hate the people.
That's Hans-Georg Maaßen, the former head of Germany's domestic security agency, the BFV. He's now under observation himself by his former agency for his potentially right-wing extremist leanings. Is Bolshevikism entering your vocabulary?
It's a thing, Bolshevikism. I don't know that anybody actually gets called a Bolshevik in anger in Europe anymore. Right? I mean, it seems very quaint. It's like it'll be like being called a suffragette, Menshevik, splitter. Whereas wokeism is, you know, that does get used quite a bit.
I do have to say, though, that I found the comments by Melanie Phillips, who spoke at NatCon after they prevailed and they got the court order. I found her comments to be in uniquely poor taste. She's a right-wing political commentator and journalist who now lives in Jerusalem. She made a very over-the-top speech, drawing a comparison between the situation in Brussels, you know, with these attempts to fight the shutdowns, with the bans on the conference, and in Israel, where 1,160 people died in the Hamas attack on October 7th, and upwards of 33,000 people in Gaza have died in Israel's subsequent military operations.
I'm a British journalist, but nowadays I live most of the time in Jerusalem. Like a few others at this conference, I was in Jerusalem last Saturday night when at 2 o'clock in the morning, the air raid siren wailed and I huddled in my stairwell for safety, listening to the explosions of dozens of ballistic and cruise missiles being shot down over my head and wondering whether any of them would hit their targets, their intended targets, us. Well, I left a war zone to come here. I didn't realize that I was coming into another war zone in Brussels. Like national conservatives, Israel is defamed and delegitimized. Its soldiers have a saying, they tried to kill us, we won, let's eat. National conservatives can now say, they tried to shut us down. We won. Now let's save the West. Thank you very much.
And some NatCon supporters also seem to over-egg the pudding by suggesting that the bans were to do with the EU itself, yeah. Right? I mean, there's a clip on right-wing TV channel GB News where Lorcan Price, a barrister who has previously spoken at NatCon, is in conversation with Nigel Farage, and they insinuate that there's some larger plot.
And you mentioned the big mayor of Brussels, Mr. Clonis. What was his involvement in
this? Yes, well, I mean, there were two other venues that cancelled before it came to this point. So I'm told Brussels has something like 19 mayors, but the big boss in the centre, he put pressure, as far as we're aware at this point, on the first venue, which is the venue I actually spoke at 2 years ago when I spoke at NatCon, Concert Nobile. Then things moved to the Sofitel, and they came under significant pressure as well. Yeah. And I think there's more to be said about who was pressuring them. I've heard rumors about that there were quite senior politicians, even from the European Union, who were pressuring them. Now, we don't know yet, but it
will come out. Well, the mayor of the district, the Sofitel.
There's also others who made the insinuation, namely Matt Goodwin, who's a populist academic blogger, now a fervent supporter of the hard right movement in Britain, and he frequently decries wokeism. Goodwin, too, insinuates that the EU is behind all of this.
What is the story today is how elites within the European Union in Brussels are trying to shut down this event. So what you have in Brussels, the home of the European Union, is an attempt to shut down debate they don't want people to have. So ironically, it's the most liberal, the most enlightened people who like to think of themselves that way who are trying to shut down the public square. I think that's unacceptable.
So my take on this over-egging is that the NatCons are very smart communicators, and I must concede they are genuine in the way they want to identify some of society's problems. But they take these convenient shortcuts that risk making those problems worse. And they then layer that with exaggeration. And the way they very opportunistically elided local decisions to shut down their conference with an EU decision, that to me just seems symptomatic of the way they let their distaste for the EU get the better of them.
I mean, I agree up to a point. Fundamentally, you know, they were harried, right? They were harassed. They were being shut down. And yes, it's a PR win, and yes, they might try to over-egg it, but fundamentally, we were not meeting in Concernoble with whoever wanted to speak. We were in a not very nice part of town, and people who had come to Brussels to give a speech weren't allowed to give it. So something fundamentally, you know, unnatural happened. That fundamental point is true. It is undeniable. After that, you know, is there a little bit of, you know, PR over-egging? Yeah, there is. Would the other side, you know, if this meeting had happened, had been a meeting of liberals in Budapest, say, or liberals in Warsaw under the previous PiS government, and somebody had been, you know, a prominent liberal person had been prevented from speaking, there would have been outrage. I mean, there would have been the EU, the Brussels bubble would have been up in arms, right? And I can name any number of MEPs, of academics, of activists who would have been, you know, disgusted and demanded the right of people to speak. And actually, I think it's pretty notable here that those people were not speaking up, right? I'm not going to name names.
No,
plenty of appeared on this very poddaast, I might say.
Guy Verhofstadt, who is another hate figure, former Belgian prime minister, a liberal, he spoke in favor of the conference going ahead.
Okay, I on those people.
But there may be others.
There were definitely others. There were one or two kind of made some, what I thought were kind of pretty snide comments on Twitter. They'll remain nameless, but it didn't really kind of reflect very well on what are supposed to be these kind of timeless and universal principles. And it's like, well, yeah, they also apply to the people you don't like. That's the whole point. They should apply specifically to the people you don't like.
There was a further icing on the cake for the NatCons. That is the owner of Claridge, where the event was held. The events hall that was hosting NatCon and will soon host Shrek the Musical. It is owned by a Belgian Tunisian, and the NatCons made a lot of that fact. You spoke to him.
I did. And actually, I should say, this was organized by the organizers who invited me to speak to him. And this guy had quite a day, right? Quite a 24 hours. I think he got a phone call like, you know, less than 24 hours before this thing was meant to start, saying like, you know, do you have a venue? Would you be willing to host this?
Is Shrek not on this week?
That's right. No, the next thing was an Albanian concert at the weekend. So he said the room was available, and you know they took it on, you know, as a business booking. This is a businessman, right? He owns the venue. He bought it with his family. He runs it with his family for the last 10 years. And he said, you know, I really thought about this. I really thought, you know, should I allow these people who clearly I don't agree with?
He did make that point.
Oh yeah. Like he knows who's on stage.
He seemed like an utterly charming man.
Completely charming, completely wise, and said, you know, this is what is a democracy if you say that only some people are allowed to speak? Like, you know, the conservatives and the NatCons had been very polite. They'd respected the deal. They'd made a deal. They respected the deal, and ultimately, you know, there aren't many heroes in this story. He may be one of them. The Belgian police, I think, actually come out of this remarkably well, slightly passive-aggressively, not enforcing orders that were clearly not terribly wise. the NatCons are still NatCons. So if you don't like them, you're not going to like them more. Insofar as you can be critical of them, it should really just be for what was said on the stage. And there's a lot to be critical about. And by the way, like some of the stuff that was said on the stage was just either kind of unpleasant or flat out untrue. There was one guy who was saying that the European Commission didn't want people to celebrate Christmas. And my favorite was that the European Commission didn't want people to support their national football team. I mean, these are complete canards, right? This is complete nonsense. And at the same time, some of the stuff that was said on stage was perfectly reasonable, right? And, you know, it was thought provoking and I learned a lot and, you know, it made me reflect on the union. I didn't agree with it, but there you go. How do you know what the good ideas are if you don't listen to the bad ideas?
Yeah, and that's the principled, admirable stance that the Belgian Tunisian owner of the venue took. But the thing is that he is exactly the kind of person that key members of the NatCon movement say that they don't want living in Europe. And, you know, Viktor Orban tweeted from the conference this week with the hashtag no migration. Mm. And he made a thinly veiled reference to keeping out non-whites just this week. And Mr. Ben, as they called this owner of the venue, Mr. Ben gave Farage and the NatCons a chance to paint over the issue of their xenophobia/racism. It was a...
He's literally providing the platform.
It's an odd moment.
It is an odd moment. I think... You have to draw the line somewhere, right? Like you, there is a line, right? It's stupid to say that there isn't a line, right? If there's a bunch of guys who come in with swastikas, clearly there's going to be a problem. If there's a bunch of guys who are centrists, clearly there's not going to be a problem. And there's a spectrum. Now, one thing we should be clear about is the organizers of this conference, the main guys, is this Edmund Burke Foundation in the US. And I spoke to their head.
Yoram Hazoni.
Yeah. I spoke to their head, Yoram Hazoni. And he said, you know, we put in a considerable amount of effort not to mix with the wrong ones, right? That they are very conscious of the fact when they organize conferences that people might have ideas that they don't necessarily endorse the ideas, but they have a sense of where they should draw the line. Now, we might agree or disagree as to whether they get it right, but they also see that there is a line. And frankly, I didn't hear anything. I was only there for the first day, but I didn't hear anything in that first day that is, you know, so beyond the pale that a liberal society should not be able to hear it. Maybe the second day was different. Viktor Orban was there. He's always, you know, provocative.
What does this tell us more broadly about the far right and elections and how they should be involved in our sort of modern democracies? And Stanley, you've long disdained what is called the cordon sanitaire.
Yeah, and I think this is actually at the core of it, right? And it's a particularly Belgian story.
And this is a French term that refers to isolating perceived extremists, which is what people tried to do here. That term is to some extent rooted in Belgian politics from the 1980s, to exclude the far-right Flemish nationalists like the Vlaams Bloc at that time, now the Vlaams Belang, from coalition governments. The term is now applied much more widely than Belgium, also applies to the way the European Parliament has declared a cordon sanitaire on the far-right Identity and Democracy Group, or the ID Group, which contains the Vlaams Belang, contains the Alternative for Germany party,
the Austrian FPO.
The Austrian FPO, Marine Le Pen's party too. But you'd argue, I guess, that generally the cordon sanitaire model hasn't worked somehow? Or is your beef that it's wonky from a more sort of philosophical point of view?
It's both, actually. Firstly, in theory, it's not great. And in practice, it's terrible, right? So let's start with the practice, right? Having this policy of cordon sanitaire in Belgium has clearly not worked. We're about to have national elections in Belgium and regional elections in Flanders, two parties that are beyond the cordon sanitaire, the Vlaams Belang, which is really, really far out, and the NVA, the new Vlaamse Alliance, which is also pretty far out. These are two parties in the European Parliament that would be in the sort of beyond the pale.
Strictly speaking, the Cordon Sanitaire is with the ID group.
I don't know. Like the Sweden Democrats are in the ECR, and they were considered to be beyond the Cordon Sanitaire. Eric Zemmour, who we were discussing earlier, he is in talks or may already be in the ECR. So anyway, one of the issues is that these parties of the hard right hate each other so much, right, that you need to have two separate groups because there are so many conflicts domestically. For example, in between the Rassemblement National in France of Marine Le Pen and her niece, Marion Maréchal, who is standing with Éric Zemmour. And of course, even within those micro parties, they hate each other. But there you go. So it hasn't worked in practice. And I think it's given those parties of the hard right a tremendous boost. It's given them this aura of being, you know, the only people who are saying stuff that other people aren't allowed to say. A good example is Giorgia Meloni. Right? Giorgia Meloni in Italy was, for several years, she was the only opposition because the cordon sanitaire was such that you couldn't make an alliance with her. And so all the liberal parties came together into one great, big, mushy, indecisive alliance, and she was the only person on the other side. And lo and behold, of course, the next elections come and you're going to vote for the opposition, and she was coherent and she won. So it's clearly just a bad policy. And in France, it's going to be the same thing, right? Everybody has said for years, you can't vote for Front National. You can't vote for Rassemblement National.
This is
Marine Le Pen's party. And every time they kind of, you know, get to the second round of the presidential runoff, and people start asking, like, why are we allowed to vote for those people? The second thing is, part of the reason I don't like the cordon sanitaire, beyond the fact that it doesn't work, is this is a spectrum, right? There are clearly some people that are really far, far beyond the pale. I mean, Eric Zemmour, for example, was convicted, right? In a court of law, you might say that makes him permanently beyond the pale or not. But there's clearly some parties that are essentially banned by law, and it's probably a good thing at the very, very extremes. And there are some that are just a little bit conservative, right? Some people put Boris Johnson and the conservatives, the Brexity conservatives, in that hard right category. Certainly Trump kind of would be in it. I mean, he's from the Republican Party, right? This is one of the two parties in the US. And so it goes until you get to someone like Marine Le Pen, who I think, you know, inherited a party that was really, really on the hard, hard, far extreme right, and is now saying a lot of things that are not particularly contentious, right? She no longer wants to leave the euro. She no longer wants to leave the EU. She wants to stop migration. But, you know, so do a lot of voters, and so do a lot of centrist parties now. So I just don't like this division. It's a very unhealthy one. And then the third thing, and which I'm going to rail against, is the compromise that was arrived at in Europe, is that we are not going to have government alliances. We're not going to have formal coalitions with these parties, but we will allow them to support us in what are called these confidence and supply deals, where they don't get ministers, so they're not formally part of government. However, because we need their MPs to win votes of confidence, to get legislation passed, we're essentially going to allow them to influence government policy. And that gives these parties of the hard right, for example, the Sweden Democrats is a good example, the ability to hugely influence government policy. I mean, they're partly writing government programs, but they're not accountable. There is no minister there that you can point to and you can say, you know what? Like, this guy is a rotten guy. And I think we've seen instances
where... They can still threaten to bring down the government.
Which
is what Democrats do.
Exactly. Yeah. And
especially on the migration issue.
And what we have seen time and again is...
pushing it further and further to the right.
That's right. And what we've seen time and again is that some of these governments, when they get into power, some of these far-right parties, when they get into power, are basically inept. And they crumble under the weight of their contradictions. So we had seen that, for example, in Austria when they had come into power, and they're just not very good, and they kind of go, they disappear. We've seen, I think, something similar in Norway. And that's what happens to junior coalition parties. I mean, ask the Lib Dems in Britain, right? And because of this cordon sanitaire, I think it's one of the reasons why we've never kind of excised this line of thinking, and we give it this kind of mythical importance that, you know, they speak in ways that you're not allowed to think. I think that's deeply unhealthy in a democracy.
I think that's really well stated, Stanley, but I also think that we need to sort of reflect what the fears are about these parties. And there is an argument that they are less conservatives and more extremists, even the NatCons. Another way of maybe summarizing what happened this past week is that race-baiting, Islamophobic, anti-same-sex marriage, anti-abortion, erstwhile Putin admirers in suits and ties and gowns and silk scarves who have very deep ties to Viktor Orban and Hungary's fossil fuel-funded culture war on Europe and on EU leaders and on George Soros, as well as ties to the Israeli far right, and who spout unfounded theories about the deliberate replacement of white Christian Europeans by elites. And they kind of got a free pass on all of that because they could double down on being professional censorship victims.
Yeah.
You know, who get gagged by anyone to their left. Just to give you an example, at one point at the conference, I'm sitting there and I'm chatting to a guy from Los Angeles who called members of Black Lives Matter vermin. And he started shaking with rage, shaking with rage. And that's really, in a way, for me, why them getting the free pass and getting all the positive publicity was also a bit of a concerning development. In a way, we're kind of contributing to by doing this podcast. It does distract attention from the political platforms of each of these people.
Yeah, that's right. I mean,
Muslim hate, anti-woman, anti-gay, even to some degree, anti-Semitism.
Even to some degree, anti-Semitism, for sure. To be clear, like, the aim is not to agree with them or to accept what they say as valid points. I write for The Economist. We are fundamentally a liberal, open, pro-globalization type of publication. So we completely disagree with them. So this is more like a strategy of how you combat this in a liberal way, in an open society. You tolerate it to combat it. It is not a question of saying, actually, kind of, we agree with these people and, you know, we think they're wonderful. It doesn't mean they can't have some good ideas. It doesn't mean that some of their criticisms of the way we think, I use we in a very broad sense, the way we think is somehow misguided, but they have to be able to make their points. We have to be able to address them, to disagree with them, to combat them. But that's the point. It needs to be combat without the police in the back is what it needs to be.
Yeah, and the ultimate fear, and I think it's a legitimate one, is that they get into power and they dismantle democracy.
They don't reciprocate.
And they take away civil rights. You know, yeah, are they
being
naive? Would they behave the same way, you know, were the shoe on the other
foot?
Well,
they've certainly made a big song and dance about the importance of free speech, right? So there is that.
We've got that on the record.
I agree. I mean, if you look at the amount of time that the Hungarian opposition got on national public broadcast TV at the last election, these are not people who apply liberal principles. However, like, what we're talking about here is something which is even more fundamental. And I don't think that we have seen police kind of break up liberal conferences in Hungary. Maybe in India. You know, we can have a different conversation about that. That's a, you know, erstwhile liberal polity that has taken a turn, I think, towards kind of genuine harassment of liberals. But in the EU, I think it would be unfair to say that we have seen kind of that degree of harassment of liberals.
I mean, freedom of speech is really a live issue right now. And part of that is to do with Gaza and Israel. And we've had these pro-Palestinian rallies and a conference that have been suppressed in France and last week in Germany. I think Yanis Varoufakis,
right.
was
a guy who I have absolutely no truck with. But, you know, again, it seems completely insane. Like, this guy is being canceled for saying stupid things. I mean, I completely disagree with him, probably nearly as much as I disagree with some of what Viktor Orban says. But, these are very bad precedents. But the good news is, I think people still see these things as being problematic. People still see, I mean, it was just so obvious what happened at this conference was wrong. It's a really easy thing to argue. It's nearly kind of too obvious. So we're still at that stage. Will we be at that stage in another 10 years' time? Yeah, I mean, I hope so. I completely take your point about, you know, will the other side reciprocate? I think the structures that exist, what some of these conservatives call the deep state, not lovingly, they don't use the term lovingly, but, you know, whether it's the deep state because of, you know, European norms or these courts, these pesky courts that, you know, intervened in favor of NatCon this week. I think those things are very, very hard to dismantle. So I think there is a kind of a liberal bedrock of society that endures. It's probably a good thing to test it once in a while. There it was tested and it worked.
It's super interesting. I would go back to the podcast that I had with Marcus Becker of Spiegel magazine just a few weeks ago. And he was talking about how now is the time to reinforce the German constitution. Mm. And there are ways to do that. So that liberal bedrock is even more solid.
Yep.
And I think that's an interesting approach right now, because if they do get into power and they do not keep their side of the democratic bargain, we are going to want some very stable institutions. Yeah. But as we know, there are thinkers
like Suella Braverman,
well,
who was actually at the conference saying, we need to get out of the European Convention of Human Rights because it is protecting the rights of migrants that come into Britain. And it means that we can't enforce our Rwanda policy. But, you know, once you start dismantling the European Court of Human Rights, that's actually a whole body of law that you are dismantling that is probably, you know, doing the job that this Belgian court did.
Certainly informed part of it. Yeah,
yeah, absolutely.
The European Court of Human Rights would have informed part of 100%. That decision making.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, the other point made by some of these democratic thinkers, which I find it's intriguing, it's disturbing, is that in some ways, democracy is about good faith.
Yeah. Right?
And it's never really, you can't guarantee its solidity.
No.
It is something that, in a way, relies on forbearance, ultimately. And
yeah, the right people doing the right thing.
One last point. There's the mother of all hard right conferences coming up. It's called CPAC. It was born in the 1970s in the US, and now, like NatCon, it's becoming part of the European scene, largely because of backing by the Hungarians and Viktor Orban. It's coming up this week. CPAC positions itself as part of, quotes, the international convergence of national forces.
Mm-hmm.
That's always a bit of a brain tease. In any case, the next iteration of the conference, CPAC 2024, is taking place this week in Hungary. And irony, it has been refusing journalists accreditation. Journalists that it deems woke or from woke organizations like The Guardian. I mean, you know, that's not exactly consistent with the free exchange of ideas that we heard so much about this week in Brussels from so many of the same people who likely be attending CPAC or have done so in the past.
Yeah. I mean, arguably, you know, a conference is free to accredit whoever they want to whatever they want. They should let The Guardian in, but if they don't want to, it is their rights. But it sends a weird signal. I think those conferences will go on possibly until November, right? If Trump wins, I think people in Europe will keep on being interested in them. If Trump loses, I doubt that we will, you know, see very much of, I think that whole US influence will disappear pretty quickly. And maybe Orban will disappear.
So that's it for this episode. And I just wanted to say a word to all our new and returned listeners. We love having you here. And we hope you love our blend of news and views from people who are really in the know. But I'm not going to lie. Journalism of all kinds is experiencing an epic financial crisis. What that means for you is that over time, you're getting a narrowing range of opinions. Now, there are those of us fighting back, but we too are at risk of going away, unless people pay for it. So if you're an EU Scream regular, and many of you are, it's time to make a pledge, even just a small one. It only takes a few clicks at Patreon or at the donate button on our website. from just €1 a month to something more, it's all vital. Vital to pay for what it takes to make good, enriching listening. EU Scream's nonprofit journalism is made possible by your donations, partnerships, and by advertising. And we're grateful to the Laura Kinsella Foundation for an annual grant. For more details and for more EU Scream, visit euscream.com. I'm James Cantor. Thanks for listening.